Child Whisperer. It's been said we're 20 ways away from a barbarian culture. That's probably a little harsh. But the point was, we're just one generation away from being barbarians, because what we are is largely dependent upon what we produce and what we train. Child Whisperer. How are we as parents and congregations to help our young people get on their feet and take responsibility for deciding on career and vocation? How can we train them to take on a role of responsible Christian, including such things as providing for themselves and their families, accepting responsibilities for their part in the congregation? What is the difference, if any, between leading, training, and controlling? How do we do this so that we effectively work ourselves out of a job and our children become independent, responsible adults making their own choices? What is the role of fathers as leaders of the home? Probably 9 lessons right there. When I first read that, one of the things that struck me, the question, how do we effectively work our ways out of a job? I question whether a lot of parents want to work their ways out of a job. Umbilical cords can stretch for miles. Child whisperer. A whisperer is, according to the dictionary, obviously a person who whispers, but that's not my lesson. There are probably parents here that wish their child were child whisperers, oftentimes during the assembly when they're not. But the second definition is the one I was asked to really deal with. A child whisperer is someone who is skilled in taming or training a specific kind of animal, typically using body language and gentle voice encouragement rather than physical contact. When I ponder that, I don't know where this title came from. It could come from one of two places, possibly. There's been several TV shows, dog whisperers, horse whisperers, various things where people talk dogs into doing what they're supposed to. Last fall, there was a book that came out entitled Child Whisperers by a lady by the name of Carol Tuttle. And she, on the cover, it says, an ultimate handbook of raising happy, successful, cooperative children. Well, I know that's not true, because the Bible is the ultimate handbook on doing that. Pardon me, Dan, but I did go on YouTube to listen to this lady, and I found her voice rather grating. And I haven't read the book, but the context of the blog that I listened to, it was an old girl in a new dress, and I don't mean that as a sexist comment. She's got these four patterns, and your child fits into one of these boxes, and then you relate to that child as if you've ever gone to a sales training class. It's the same stuff. That doesn't make it wrong. It just makes it a bit old. It is a biblical concept, though, because in Proverbs 22:6 it says, train up a child in the ways that he should go. In other words, know your child. If you have more than one child, you best not raise them exactly the same way. You need to be consistent, but you best not raise them exactly the same way, or you're going to be disappointed with the results, because they are two different people. When we think of growth, be it physical or be it spiritual, there is simply no way to microwave growth. And by that I mean you just can't short-circuit growth. It takes time. It takes nurturing, whether we're talking about physical growth or spiritual growth. There is no instant sudden growth. Spiritual growth is more of a crockpot time. If you do it right, it takes time, but you end up with something that's very tender, very delectable. There are definite stages in the development, whether we're talking physically or spiritually, that you simply can't skip. You may skip a grade in school. My mom skipped the third grade. She must have been smart. She regretted it because socially it was probably a bad move, but she skipped the third grade. Maybe some of you skipped. But when it comes to growing up, you can't. We all start in birth and infancy, whether it's physical or spiritually. Peter talks about that in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, how as babes we desire the sincere milk of the word. You just can't skip that phase. That's sometimes called the help me phase, because of all of God's creation, probably mankind is the most helpless as an infant. A colt gets up and frolics in a few hours. We just lay there. But it is a time of intense dependence. Selfishness, really. We cry when we want this, and we cry till we get it. Little concept of danger as an infant. Little discernment. We'll put anything in our mouths. We'll crawl anywhere. Whether we're talking physically or spiritually. Then comes childhood. This is kind of a teach me stage. And our children don't necessarily come up and say, teach me, although they might, but they say it in different ways. They're like sponges, and they absorb. Sometimes they absorb more than we want them to absorb. They look up to us when we wish they didn't. No really way of changing that. It's just the way it is. It's a period of learning. Tell me. It's a time when you'll get lots of why questions, which you'll answer, and it's followed by a why, and it's followed by a why, and it's followed by a why until you get tired. But it's also an easily kidnapped period. It's a dangerous stage. Some have called it the milk carton stage. It's that stage when children often find we find their pictures on a milk carton because somebody's taken them because they were overly trusting. Limited discernment. But those are only ways to get to what I've been asked to talk about. We come to the concept of adolescence. And if I understand what they've asked me to really address is, how do we encourage, how do we nurture, how do we discipline, how do we whatever, our adolescence? And you can define that age, but I'm going to talk about it somewhere between 14 and 22, but it varies. It's a period, it seems to me, of ambivalence. It's in a period of extremes. It's a period of high opinionation. Not always based on fact, but neither are ours. It's described as a period of idealistic thinking with unrealistic expectations. And I think that's a real important thing for us to notice. Idealistic thinking. This is the way it ought to be, but unrealistic expectations and expecting it to always be that way. Some call this the show me stage, maybe with a curled lip. They look at us as adults and say, okay, show me. You've been telling me, now show me. Put your money where your mouth is would be a way that we might say it. Let's see if you can walk the and not simply talk the talk. I think those are legitimate things to challenge us adults on. And when they don't see us walking the walk or putting our money where our mouth is, they're disillusioned. Maybe the most important thing I'm going to say today, this is my opinion, if you and I wait until they are adolescents to try to mold and shape them, we are way too late and we're probably going to fail. This needs to start in the infancy and in the childhood stage. Now, if we find ourselves with adolescents that we, for various reasons, haven't done a particularly good job with, let's not give up. I'm just saying it is a really steep hill. It is a very steep hill. The key to successful adolescence is largely a successful infancy and childhood. It's what we learn in those early stages that sets the tone for how we are going to come out. Because adolescence is a self-oriented stage. It's a selfish stage. And we all have gone through that, and some of you are in it. It's a selfish stage. It's about me. It's about I. It's a time when we have to learn to live with and deal with uncertainty and the suppressing of immediate gratifications. And that's why some of us are still adolescents. We're Peter Pans. Peter Pan was the little boy that never grew up. That's what that whole story is about. Adolescence is largely a time when a young person wants the privilege of childhood while demanding the rights of being an adult. That'd be great if you could pull that off. The privileges of being a child. No worries, no cares, being taken care of, but the rights of being adult, and I can do what I want when I want, and you shouldn't tell me what to do. Well, those of us that have become adults know that really never happens because you always got a boss. I don't think there's a teacher here that doesn't really understand that concept and what we're trying to say. It's the wanting of blessings without responsibilities. We have a lot of 14 to 22-year-old people here that are not adolescents. They have already grown through that. They've passed some of us up with light speed, and God bless them. One of my prayers is that the next generation will do better than my generation. I did okay, but you guys messed it up. Tongue in cheek. We always dream that for the next generation. Our challenge, our task is to help them get through this, and maybe for them to help us get through it. But always remember that the church can seldom do what the family has done. We can talk about church responsibilities till we're blue in the face, but the tone is set in the family. That's where it ought to be set, and that's where it is set. I have had great pleasure in this area doing VBSs, and I cherish that, although it may be about time for others to take that over, but I'm saddened when parents will give them to us for 1 week and then not do anything the other 51 weeks and expect it to turn out okay. It doesn't. You can't do in 1 week what's being done in another week. I'm going to look at a passage in Matthew chapter 10, which I wouldn't have necessarily initially thought of this. But as introduction to this, this is when Jesus is selecting his apostles and sending them out. And the reason I think this has some significance for us, do you realize that Jesus turned over his kingdom to a group of young people, probably somewhere in the ages of 18 to 30. All of them had 4 or less years of spiritual maturity. That's who he turned the kingdom over to. Yes, they had the Holy Spirit, and maybe they had it in ways that we don't necessarily have it, but I find that to be absolutely amazing. And when I go to Matthew chapter 10, I'm going to read the first 10 verses and make a couple of comments on it. In Matthew chapter 10, he's selecting his apostles and he's sending them out. So let me just read the first 10 verses. And when he had called his 12 disciples, he gave them power against unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease. Now the names of these apostles are these: the first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, and Philip, and Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew the publican, James the son of Alphaeus, and Lebeus, whose surname is Thaddeus, and Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, Go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely have you received, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver, nor brass for your purses, nor scrip for your journey, neither 2 coats, neither shoes, nor staves, for the worker is worthy of his meat. Now, what does that have to do with my subject? Well, we're told in other passages that Jesus then sent them out 2 by 2. Point number one. Companionship. There is nothing more important for any of us, possibly, but there is certainly nothing more important for our adolescents than having the appropriate companionship. in Mark chapter 6, verse 7. He sent them out two by two. Because you find yourself encouraged by surrounding yourself with others of like faith. That's true irregardless of our age. It's true of you. It's true of me. It's true of our youth. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, chapter 4, verse 9 and following, it says, two are better than one, and a threefold cord is not easily broken. We often use that in marriage, but I think it has relational aspects. What is my point? One of the things I think we can do, and to some extent I'm preaching to the choir because many of you are doing this, and that's why you're here, is to make sure our young people have an opportunity to be with other young people who share the faith, and they don't feel like they are alone, and they make themselves very much a part of an institution. Randy gave a little commercial, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, to what Smart Road's going to try to do later. Whether you can come or not, that's an individual decision, but that is an opportunity. I grew up in a congregation that when I was growing up, we hosted the two-week meeting three times, and I don't know how many Labor Day meetings we hosted. I remember fondly as a boy, teenage boy growing up, and I would see men like Doug Weekly, who was newly married. Frank Green stayed at our house. That's when I first met Kenny Long, and he was trying to play softball in Court Arlene at the same time, and that was a disaster. I met the Warren girls at those meetings. I still have notes from Richard Riggins, Jim Basinger, Marvin Engel from those meetings. They changed my life. That's what I'm saying. I was talking to Melda before I got at the break, and we're a little fuzzy on the dates. But my history with this meeting goes back over 50 years, probably 53. I think it was about 1963 when I first came to a Vandalia meeting. I could not drive. We had an elder at our congregation named Chick Powell, who was sometimes a little rough around the edges, but he was always right in the heart. He piled me and four or five other teenagers into his station wagon, and off we came to Vandalia. Chick Powell was the only driver. We would leave about 10 or 11 p.m. on Friday night and get here about 9 a.m. We would pile out. I remember as if it was yesterday piling out in front of this mailbox over here and finally seeing what a Marvin Engel looked like. And I've never forgotten it. I went to my first two-week meeting in 1964, 1967. I went to one at Gregory Boulevard and met a girl by the name of Donna Siekman, who is now Donna Lee. I moved to Kansas City in 1970. I was 21, right out of college. There was a young study group of people 19 to 23. We would get together and study. Dan and Gaylene Green were part of that and other people you might remember. 1968, Martinsville hosted the two-week meeting. I got I don't know if it was honor. I kept Lowell Herman and Rick Sparks, so you decide that. My point is, friendships were being formed that I had no idea would last. And now I'm talking to you 55 years later. Friendships are being formed here. It's gold, absolute gold. My appreciation for Marvin was such that in 1973, when Donna and I got married, we asked Marvin to come down and officiate our wedding, which he did, April 27, 1973. On May 25, 1973, I was back in Vandalia standing up with Greg as he married Margaret. I stood on the boy's side. Friendships that last forever. They're golden. Cherish them, but as adults, let's give them the opportunity. I go to a congregation, which will be nameless, wonderful people. It is probably the average highest IQ congregation I go to. Now, I've not given them a test, so that's just my opinion. But it's not a big congregation. We sit around a table and we study. I think the average IQ in that congregation is probably around 130, if you ask me to guess, and that's probably above average. But they've lost all their young people. And one of the reasons is they never brought their young people to gatherings like this. I remember once seeing men from that congregation at this meeting about 30 years ago. They stood under by a tree by themselves because they didn't know anybody and they didn't assimilate. Are they wonderful people? Yes. But there was a loss of companionship. Secondly, there is an area of delegation. And I believe Dwayne mentioned this yesterday afternoon. If my notes are right, if he didn't, then it's okay. But I think he did mention it. Giving young people an opportunity to participate by delegating to them is such an important thing to do. Have you noticed who does the announcing here? It's been that way for years. I don't know the last time I saw an elder up here making announcements. Now, I haven't talked to them, but I'm guessing that that's not accidental. And the younger men have done a wonderful job. Could Greg and Charles do as well? I doubt it. But they could do it. You know, they could do it. The point is getting them to participate, not just doing the reading, not just passing the envelope. Those are fine things, but sinking their teeth in. People who feel a part of our youth, they get committed. It pays wonderful dividends. They could have hired an evangelist to do all the announcements. I don't think it would have been near as good. And you and I have sat in seats and watched some people up there doing it and thinking, man, this is a struggle. Well, maybe it is. But it's a growing struggle. It's a growing struggle. When you delegate, now it has to be with guidance, but when you delegate, you're thinking long term and not just short term. Could you do it better? Maybe. But long term, you and I aren't going to be here. It's a wonderful thing. Jesus delegated. Could he have done that by himself? Sure. But he said, I'm going to send you out two by two to do it. The third thing is the idea of, well, I don't want that title. What do I want? Materialism. In the latter part of the passage I read for you, verses 9 and 10, he says, don't worry about your silver and gold, your script. Well, he knew they had to eat. But he was teaching them that things are not what is important. Paul talks about this in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18. If your life is driven simply by your five senses, you are not mature. I don't care how age you are. If we are simply driven by things that we can feel and touch and see, you're not very mature because we're to walk by what? Faith, not sight. And that's a terribly important lesson to teach our young people. It's not that those things are wrong, but they're simply not enough. They're simply not enough. I had a young person come up to me not too long ago, and he said, you know, I don't need a whole lot to live on. I thought, that's good, because we don't. We don't. We've got, but we don't. Mature perspective. Let me give you now just a few practical bullets. I don't have all of the answers. If I did, I'd be a better parent and a better evangelist. But number one, we've got to give them the right role model. They've got to see us walking the walk and not just talking the talk. Paul talks about that when he writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 11, 12, and 13. I think, secondly, it is appropriate to set expectations. We all should have expectations of one another. I expected my boys to meet certain bars and tried to encourage them to do it. It's interesting. They come back to me now and say, we wished you had pushed us harder. Well, that's good to say when you're 35. I think if we'd have pushed them harder when they were 15, it might have backfired. But that's just my opinion. We need to trust with controlled delegation. I'm not talking about turning them loose, but to plan a meeting, to plan an activity. It is amazing to me how hard it is for some adults to delegate. I love to delegate. Makes it easier on me, and maybe it teaches some. Now, of course, I'm not talking about no guidance. And we need to encourage, and I think probably most every speaker here has touched on the word encouragement. I believe that one of the most valuable ways to encourage is praise, and this is irregardless of one's age, praise when the right thing is done. You know how we learn to talk? Now, you can quibble with these numbers, but I think the principle is straight. The human mouth can make about 35 different sounds. But you and I don't make 35 different sounds. We make about 18 or 19. Some sounds we don't make because we weren't encouraged to make them. When our babies start to make certain sounds, if it's even close to mom, we just jump up and down. Well, what's that kid going to do? He's going to try that again. I don't think they want to say mama. We just get so excited, they like to see us getting excited. There are some sounds that I can't make with my mouth. So I can't speak some languages. Now, maybe I could learn them, but as an adult, it's awful hard to learn some of those. They have clicks and donks and... Well, I can't make them, so I don't know what I'm trying to do. You learn to speak because you are encouraged by the excitement of those around you when you even get close. Back in Judges chapter 12, verse 5, and I'm not going to turn to it. The Gileads had encountered the Ephraimites, and the Ephraimites were trying to come back. Remember, they said, if you can pronounce this word, then we know you're legit. And the word was Shibboleth. And the Ephraimites couldn't do SH. So it came out Shibboleth, I guess. Why? Because they weren't encouraged to make an SH sound. So that wasn't part of their language. Well, we're not going to try to get these people to say Shibboleth. I mean, they probably could. But when you encourage somebody when they do something well, that is such a tremendous pace setter. I remember a study that was done. This was in a psychology class. And I think it's true. The students got together and said, they had this professor that wasn't too, he was kind of bad. He was boring. That's the word I'm looking for. Boring. And they said, when he sits on his desk, we're going to act disinterested. And if he goes over, and he did periodically, and sits on the radiator, we're going to take notes feverishly. They did that for two or three class sessions. And by the third class session, that guy was sitting on the radiator the whole time. They never said a thing. He was responding to that positive reinforcement. Now, this is true for all of us, but it can be true. When they do well, when they work hard, when they use wise decisions in their money, that's the time to say, attaboy, or a girl, that a person. That has tremendous impact. Has tremendous impact. I had somebody offer me $10 today for this tie. You think I'm going to wear it again? You bet I am. I'll get 15 before the week's over. We respond to that kind of thing. Let me just tick off a few others because I don't want to keep you much past time. And this is hard for parents and for all of us that are older. Do not enable them. Do not enable them. There is sometimes such a tendency to not make them have to go through some of the struggles we went through. You know what you're doing? You're denying them the opportunity to grow the way you grew. When our boys were growing up, we had an old truck. Charles would like this, my old truck. It had a heater and a key, and that's all it had. When the guy sold it to me, he said, all you get is a heater and a key. That was the truck the boys drove until they could afford their own transportation. Was that a little hard on them? Yeah. I thought it was pretty neat, but I wanted them to say, if you want it, you earn it. I'll provide for you, but don't expect a Corvette. And they would say, we can't even expect a car. Now, I'm a little tongue-in-cheek, but I have seen so many parents who have had hard times growing up inundate their children with things to keep their children from having to go through the very things that made them grow up. We need to teach them and to show them there are consequences for our action. There's an elder that I have great respect for. His son was arrested, not on a terrible charge. He was arrested for a traffic violation. He hadn't paid a previous traffic violation. They put him in handcuffs and put him in jail. So his son called him from jail, this elder, and I almost said his name, and I don't want to. He went down and visited his son in jail, said, okay, I'll be back tomorrow. And the kid spent the night in jail. And he needed to. He needed to. Well, maybe that's a little bit harsh, but I'm not sure that it is. There was an elder that was, he's now dead in Martinsville, that I worked for, named Woody Estes. Some of you knew Woody. Of all the things that Woody Estes taught me is he taught me how to work. And that is a wonderful lesson to learn. It's a wonderful lesson to learn. How do we help them make good vocational decisions? How do we help them make good church decisions? We just teach them the basic things that life is made of. Not to be harsh on them. How to handle their money. You do it the way you want. When we would go on vacation, when the boys were young, you know how, if you go on vacation with little kids, they want to buy this, they want to buy that, they want to buy this, they want to buy that, and I'm frugal enough that I knew that wasn't going to work. So we gave, and this is 30 years ago, so factor in inflation, we gave both boys $20. We went on a two-week vacation. Here's your $20. And I don't want to hear about you wanting money. You got it. And they were totally different. One of them was out in 5 days, and the other one brought back 15. I didn't care. They had to learn that. You remember the Michael Air Jordan tennis shoes that cost more than my suits? The boys wanted those. Okay, here's $50. You want Air Jordan? You put in the other 70. It's all part of teaching that there are responsibilities. There are consequences. And so many children, not these. These are jewels over here. I'm not even looking at them because I don't want to embarrass them. These are jewels. These are the cream of our... Well, most of them. No, just kidding. Just kidding. Just kidding. I was going to say in here, and I left it out, but I'll say it now. One of the things I admired about Marvin and Melda is they raised three wonderful kids, and 3 out of 4 is not bad. But I didn't want to put that in. Seriously. We have such a wonderful group. I had the privilege in January of coming up to Martinsdale, and they had Iowa something. I don't even know what it's called. But it was a bunch of young people that get together periodically and stuff, and it was just a joy. But I tell you a highlight of that, there were two young women who drove 3 hours one way to get there to spend that 24 hours with us. Because they wanted to be with their friends, and the nurturing of that, and in areas I see that some young people don't have that privilege. They're in congregations that are a long ways away from other young people. That's why this is so important. Maybe you don't have kids anymore. Be a chick pal and fill your van up and go. I owe a lot to people like that. My dad couldn't do that because he wasn't home. He just wasn't home. But other people did that for me. So I would say companionship, delegation, and teaching them materialism. Obviously, we could talk for a long time about this. But it is very, very important. My life is so changed because of Vandalia. It is. It's never been the same. Could I have succeeded without Vandalia? Well, I hope. But the impact that these people have had on me, and the impact that you people have had on me. I grew up with Roger. He was a couple of years younger, but not much younger. Debbie. You don't realize the friends you're making are going to be your friends in 50, 60 years. I don't know which ones it's going to be, but it's going to be some of them. And that's wonderful. And I'm looking at some parents that put a lot of effort into getting their young people to these things. And that will pay dividends. I don't want to embarrass anybody. I could call out names of people right here in this audience. But since they're not here, I'll call them out. And that's Brian and Tammy Schreck. I don't call them out bad. They would drive an hour and 15 minutes one way to Pleasant Hills VBS year after year. Brian would get up and go to work the next day. They would come 2.5 hours round trip and get those kids there. Now they've got two beautiful girls that are married to Christian men and a young man who I think just graduated from high school that looks to me like he's well on his way. You think that happened by accident? They could have done that and it not turned out as well as it did, sure. Those things pay such rich dividends. Such rich dividends. We are so blessed. There are congregations that are thousands of miles away from the nearest fellowship that we would call doctrinally correct. We are so blessed. Take advantage of it, guys. You are. So I'm preaching to the choir. You are. But encourage others. And those of us that are a little older, don't get too tired to help make it happen. Help make it happen. I remember Dave gave a talk not too long ago about how he'd drill these kids on what they learned in church as they were going home or something to that effect. That pays dividends. He's got four kids, great kids. Well, they're not kids, four offsprings in the church. It doesn't always happen that way. We can do everything right and still have it wrong. I tell people if perfect parents made perfect kids, we'd all be perfect because God's a perfect father. But we need to do the best we can. These things are tiring, but they're so valuable. Would it be easier for Randy and Gerald not to host the thing at Smart Road? Sure it would. They could go to Colorado. But it pays dividends, and they want to be part of it. And I applaud them for it. I have no ox in that activity. Other people are doing that, and that's the way it ought to be. Fill up your station wagon. Delegate. And teach them. But you can't teach what you don't know. You can't teach what you don't know. We're going to close our thoughts and extend the gospel invitation. Roger has selected a song for us. If there's anybody here, it's been a total delight to be with you and a total appreciation to the congregation here for having their 50-plus Vandalia meeting. I understand next time we're here, this auditorium will be bigger maybe than it is. That doesn't happen by accident. That doesn't happen by accident. It's a blessing, but it doesn't happen by accident. If we can help anybody in any way, if you have something you need to share or obey the gospel, we invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.